Greetings, creep. Thanks for calling our secret hotline. Press 1 if you love a good dare. Press 2 to hear about the hide-and-seek champion. You know you still love a classic tune. Press 3 for that. Press 4 for some spooky ASMR. Hit 5 for a scream of a deal. And press 6 for a palate cleanse. Any dad would love. So, you're here for the jokes, are you? Why didn't the skeleton cross the road? He didn't have the guts. What kind of monster is the best dancer? The boogeyman, of course.
I invented my own kind of grass, too. Do you know that? Look at this. This is registered. Carl Spacker invented.
Oh, yeah. I've felt grass like this before.
This is a hybrid. This is a cross. Bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, featherbed bench, and Northern California sensimilla. The amazing stuff about this is that you can play 36 holes on it in the afternoon, take it home and just get stoned in a bejesus belt that night on this stuff. I got pounds of this stuff. Here.
No, thank you. No, I don't.
So let's have a little bit of this. I got the big Bob Marley joint. Look at this. Here, try this.
Carl, I really don't do this very often.
You know, this is dynamite hack. Watch out for this.
Well, maybe one drag on that go.
It's a little harsh. But here, cannonball it. Right back. And then one more of these right on top of cannonball. Cannonball coming. Animal coming.
No!
Carl? Can I have a drop?
Just a drop? Myself?
Episode 12 of the Plants Are People 2 podcast is proudly brought to you by the Naropa School of Nihilism. Have you ever wanted to major in something but not sure what it would be? Is creative writing, interdisciplinary studies and art history all full up and you're left wondering what will come of your life? Well, the Naropa School of Nihilism is here to help. Let us walk you through the whole application and submission process and then throw it all away. Because you know what? It doesn't matter. Let us reassure you that your sense of confusion, frustration and non-direction is appropriate and you know what, just get a YouTube account, it'll be a lot cheaper and a lot more useful than college. Apply now by shredding all your application paperwork, transcripts and checks to Naropa University School of Nihilism, 2130 Arapahoe Avenue, Boulder, Colorado 80302. I wish you luck, but what for?
Good morning, everybody. We are back with another episode of the Plants Are People 2 podcast. My name is Tom Groves. I am your host for today. We had some plans to have Guardian of the Terps on with us this morning, but some things fell through, so hopefully we can reschedule that for another time. That was going to be a really great episode, talking about rhodiola and wild type autoflowering cannabis plants. But for episode 12, we're going to do a little pivot into something else for the hour. So we're going to be talking about the Caprifoliaceae family, and in particular some native plants to the New England area that are within that family. And also, we'll start off with some general ID type questions you can ask yourself when you're out in the forest or the field or the wetland and you're looking at something that you've never seen before. How to make some differential choices in what you're seeing and sort of give yourself an educated guess. So we'll start with that little part. So in if you take a botany course or, you know, something online, a field botany course, you probably will hear somebody say, you know, the acronym MAD, M-A-D, CAP, C-A-P, and HORSE. So MAD, CAP, HORSE. And MAD stands for maples, ashes, dogwoods. CAP stands for Caprifoliaceae, which we're going to talk about today. And then HORSE is horse chestnut. So, hold on a second. Zizi was just out there losing her mind at absolutely nothing, barking it. Just the wind. Madcap horse, if you're looking at a shrub or a tree in the forest, madcap horse can help you differentiate between plants that are oppositely branched and alternately branched. So this little acronym just makes it really easy to be able to, you know, look at a plant that is obviously oppositely branched, and you can say, is it a maple, is it an ash, is it a dogwood, is it in the Caprifoliaceae family, or is it a horse chestnut? And, you know, for the most part, this works. Just as in everything else, there's exceptions to the rule. For example, in the dogwood genus of plants, there is the alternate leaf dogwood, so you may want to get used to what dogwood leaves look like in terms of venation, flower structure, and bark, and then you can go from there and figure out if you have that alternate leaf version of that plant. But so what we're going to dig into today is the Caprifoliaceae family. And in New England, there are 15 genera. Many of them are non-native. Some of them are invasive. Some of them have both invasive and native plants within that genus. And there are five, so of those 15 genera in the New England area, there are five that are native. And, you know, the biggest one, I think the one that people will be most familiar with is Lonicera. So Lonicera is the namesake honeysuckle for the Caprifoliaceae, which is the honeysuckle family. And, you know, in New England, there was a movement maybe around the 1850s, and probably a little early, probably a 100-year span, where people living here were obsessed with plants, horticulture from Japan, China, Korea, in some cases Eurasia, southern Russia. That's where a lot of these particular plants that have come over as ornamental varieties because of their flower size, the way they smell, and for some habitat, wildlife habitat improvement, erosion purposes. So these are all stories that we've heard before, that people who were recommending certain practices, 150, 200 years ago, were thinking they were doing the right thing by bringing these plants in. They eventually, the honeysuckles anyway, got grouped into sort of the horticultural trade. People were buying them. I think if somebody paid me $1,000, I'd probably go out and could find a nursery that was selling one of these invasive honeysuckle plants on the open market. And there's a lot of laws and rules against doing that. So if you do see that, let them know that those plants are invasive and they shouldn't be selling them. So they were brought here from China, Korea, Japan, and they've escaped into the New England landscape. They are a very common shrub that you can see in almost any habitat in the New England region. And so this invasive plant that was brought here 200 years ago has the ability to take over the understory, shade out any native regeneration trees we may have, any native regeneration of shrubs. it can change the soil chemistry. It also has the ability to shade out any native plants that we might have in the understory. Part of the other, and this goes along with other invasive plants in general, when they're introduced to an area, the lipid content or the fat content of the invasive fruits on these plants, although birds will eat them in a pinch in late winter, they may also mistakenly eat them during the growing season. And what happens is this may interrupt their migratory patterns because they won't have the necessary stored reserves they need in order to migrate, you know, down to South America or wherever they're going. So there are a lot of benefits of, you know, benefits to know what Lonicera species you have in your area and what they look like. So we're just going to run down. We'll do the invasive ones first, and then we'll do some native ones and just some common ways to tell them apart. Now, for the most part, invasive plants, when you see them, there should be this connection in your head, you know, looking at a habitat and seeing primarily one plant everywhere. You know, that the idea of this plant might be invasive should jump into your head. And these invasive honeysuckles can be very big. So think, you know, 5 feet tall to 15, 20 feet tall. Some of them can climb up into trees, and sometimes they can weigh them over. I've seen them be like 30 feet tall in some occasions. And the bark is very distinctive. As they're young, they're a little bit shaggy, but as they get older, they get more and more shaggy. And it's almost like you could peel it off in strips. And as they, you know, some of the oldest ones I've seen, what happens is they sort of twist and the bark kind of opens up to expose the wood inside. A lot of times these plants will be so heavy, they're so old and so big that they sort of pull themselves out of the ground because they're very shallowly rooted. And so those branches will layer themselves, which is just, you know, what would normally be an aerial branch will touch the ground and re-root. And so right where that stem is touching the ground, it will put down roots and start sort of a whole new plant. So a lot of times when you see honeysuckle out in the woods, and if they're old enough, it will appear to be a number of different plants, but it's really all just one plant that's sort of pushed over and spreading out into the surrounding area. So that stem of that big shrub will eventually, it kind of looks like a chola from the Western United States. If you're not familiar with that, is look it up. It's sort of it's a cactus that when it dries out, you can sort of see all the plant material on the inside, and it has a lot of holes in it. It's a very popular like decoration type thing. I don't know if they made that illegal to collect those, or I know there's been some controversy about that in the past, but it looks very similar to that. And you know, so in our New England area, we have Lonicera japonica, which is the Japanese honeysuckle. This one, I actually, you know, in speaking in layman's terms to people, you know, calling honeysuckle Japanese honeysuckle is a way to sort of, you know, make that invasive connection in their head. But the actual species, Japanese honeysuckle, has purple berries on it, white flowers, and I don't see the purple berried one as much around here, at least, you know, in the immediate vicinity. But that one is, so that's an easy ID characteristic for that one. Purple berries, white flowers. The next one is Machii, which has red berries. This one is, you know, the Japonica, Lonicera japonica, is from Japan. Macchiai's from China and Korea. Also has white flowers, but they turn yellow as they age. And then eventually those form red berries on the plant. Moroei is also from Japan. That also has red berries. There's a European species that also has red berries. That one actually, the only populations of that are up in coastal Maine. Another invasive plant in the Linaceae genus is Reticulata, which has perfoliate leaves, which just means that on a normal plant you would have two leaves coming out of the side of the stem. In this case they'd be opposite. This one the leaves sort of wrap around the stem, and it kind of looks like one big leaf with the stem just poking through it. So that's a perfoliate leaf. And that Reticulata one is a liana, which just means that it can be a vine, but it can't support its own weight. So I would imagine if, grapevines are probably like that too. But the Reticulata has yellow-orange flowers, and this one, similar to the next one I'm going to talk about, has grape-like clusters, red fruits, at the end of the inflorescence. So all these other ones have flowers in the axils of the leaves, and that's where all your fruits will show up. This one's a little different in that it's called a grape honeysuckle. All of your fruits and flowers are clustered right on the end of that inflorescence, similar to the sempervirens, which is also a vining honeysuckle. They call it trumpet honeysuckle. It has really pretty red, deep red flowers. They're very long. Hummingbirds love them. This one is more of a southern species, and it's probably at its northern range up here. And it's at this point, when you look at a range map for the invasive non-native stuff, this one is listed as native in some counties and then non-native in some others. So I found a few plants recently that were like that. So I'm sort of still mulling that over in my head as to how that can be possible. But that is, if you were going to plant one of these, if you really wanted that, I've actually planted this sempervirens on my own property. I haven't noticed that it's been any sort of invasive. I think that, that's probably, it's really pretty. It vines. You can sort of contain it, and the hummingbirds love it. So I think that's a positive one to plant in your garden if you're thinking about it. But I put it in this category just because it is non-native in some areas. The next one is Tatarica, which is a Chinese species. This one has the ability to hybridize with Moroei. And this one is another easy one to tell the difference. Those other red berry ones are kind of hard. You probably have to go and look at the underside of the leaf and see if it's hairy or not. This one has bright orange berries. So that one would stand out to most people. And then Xylostium is the Eurasian species, which also has red berries, and it's found pretty much all over the New England area. So there are some things to think about when you're trying to ID these plants. One of them we talked about earlier was actually taking a look at the habitat and seeing how this particular plant is interacting, what space it's occupying. The other is to take a look at these native plants that we have here. Some of them are rare, so it's probably unlikely that you would just come across them in the woods. Although we do have some other ones that are native. They're a lot smaller than the invasive ones, so they're a little easier to miss when walking through the forest. And these ones are Canadensis, Dioica, Hirsuta, and Oblongifolia. Hirsuta and Oblongifolia are both rare in Vermont. They both have red berries. Velosa is another one. That's an uncommon species in Vermont, so that would be an interesting one to look up for yourselves. Let's see if you've seen this one. The interesting thing about this and the ID characteristic that makes this one pretty easy to tell apart from other ones is the blue-black berries. And they sort of have a matte finish on them. Sort of that like powdery white texture that you see on blueberries sometimes, or something like maleberry or juniper. Think of juniper, what juniper berries look like, but they're almost football shaped, you know, size of a thumbnail. And so these plants, when I've seen them out in the woods, take up very little space. There's usually one plant by themselves. The leaves on the native plants are a fair bit wider, longer, more pointed, and you know, the berries also appear in a different arrangement. So a lot of times, at least on some of these, the berries appear when they're formed, they're almost connected right next to each other, and there's very few of them. So when I do see them in the forest and they do have fruits on them, there might be a dozen or less berries that are ripe. So the flowers are very small as well. They don't flower as much. They're not very prolific. And I don't know, I've never seen one like out in, you know, a big exposed meadow. It's usually on the edges of a trail, or maybe it's in sort of a more open canopy forest setting, or in a completely, you know, almost closed forest setting around wetlands. You know, so if you are doing sort of habitat restoration, trying to improve your own property, going out there and really knowing what species of Lindnersuri you have is beneficial, because you wouldn't want to pull out those native Lindnersuri species that you have. And so the Japanese honeysuckle and like the Moroei honeysuckle, those are all, you can do some hand pulling on those because they're so shallowly rooted. It is possible to get those out of the ground. And, you know, if you are unsure of your ID based on leaves, flowers, berries, bark, the sort of the gold standard for identifying whether a Lindnersuri species is native or non-native is to look at the pith, which is the center of the stem, the woody stem. And in invasive Lindnersuri species, the pith is going to be hollow. So a lot of times you'll cut that, and sometimes the small branches don't really show this. The really thin ones won't show it. But if you cut something that's sort of a little more substantial, you'll notice on the inside that it looks like a straw. There'll be a hole that'll run through the center of that branch that you cut, and it's usually brown, or it's a darker color, so you can really see that there's a just like a straw, a hole runs right through it. And the native ones, when you cut them, it'll either be very small or there won't be, it'll have a solid pith, so there won't be a straw. It'll be solid wood all the way through. So that's your, you know, you can sort of test yourself when you go out there, look at some bark, take a look at the habitat, see if you think that these are going to be invasive, and then cut one and see if the pith is hollow. And if it is, try pulling it out of the ground, or just cutting it down, or treating it with herbicide. The one good thing about honeysuckle is that they do die very easily. And starting to, you know, restore some of that habitat that these plants have taken over. So I hope that gives you a good little rundown on honeysuckle in the New England area. I do want to touch on some other things that are very interesting within this group, the Caprifoliaceae group. There's another species that we have that's native to New England, and it's called Dyervilla, which it resembles honeysuckle in the flower as well as sort of the leaf structure, the opposite branching that it has, but it's more of, it sort of takes on that ground cover type aspect to the plant. And the cool thing about this plant is you see it a lot of places. It looks kind of similar to, shout out to all the southern people, it kind of looks like dog hobble, if you've ever seen that. That's a species down south, but the leaves look similar to that. And actually down south they have a species of this, Sessilifolia, I believe is the correct name. And but in New England the Dyervilla, let me see what the species name is on this. I think it's Canadensis. Dyervilla. I'm sorry, it's Dyervilla lanicera. So it's a, you know, a callback to the lanicera family, or the lanicera genus in this other genus. And it's called, the common name would be bush honeysuckle. But it's a very low-growing, woody shrub that you see that has a lot of cool benefits. You know, when I learned about this, it was from the angle of moose and deer forage. It's also a beneficial plant for the larva of Lepidoptera species. So, you know, we have a lot of native Caprifoliaceae plants that we could be planting in native gardens to benefit a lot of different things. Especially if you live in a more northern climate, this Dyervilla would be a great addition to any sort of garden out there, any sort of wild garden. And one of the coolest things about this species of plant is that it has two different colored flowers. So I don't know where, I'm sure I could, if I really thought about it and type some stuff into Google, I could come up with other plants that have this. But I'll share, you know, when I put this out, I'll put out a post with a picture of one of these plants that was growing in my backyard, and it has orange and yellow flowers on it, which is a striking, you know, sort of color scheme to throw into any native garden, as well as just, you know, seeing that in the wild. And they flower pretty frequently, and I think they're probably pretty easy just to propagate from cutting. So if you know, went out and you found this somewhere and you took a few cuttings, you brought it back and planted it. I know I've done that on my property in a few places, trying to spread it around, because I know what the, you know, the strong benefits of this plant are. So down south, the Sessilifolia, we went down there this past summer, and I forget where we went hiking, but it was out in, it was off the Blue Ridge Parkway, and, you know, walking up this trail, up this mountain, into the fog, kind of, we could see all over the top of this. There were no trees up there. It was pretty open, shrubby, sort of like bald area. And, you know, I recognized that there were it seemed like there was 80% of the plants up there were this one species. And so I took some pictures, and it reminded me of Dyervilla, but it didn't look like the one that I was used to seeing. And so I did a little research and looked it up. And the Sessilifolia is a nice native plant down there that really takes over the top of this, these little bald areas. And it, you know, it wasn't flowering at the time I saw it, so I didn't get to see if it had similar, you know, bicolor flowers on it. And I don't, maybe someone can chime in. They look, you know, based on what I'm looking at right now on Google, it looks like they do vary in color a little bit, you know, all on that same, looks like it has more flowers per inflorescence than the Lonicera species, the dire villain Lonicera that we have in New England, but everywhere, and tons of seeds. It really looks like it occupies a lot of that space very well down there. And so those are two plants, if you live in New England or if you live down in the southern states, two really important species in the Caprifoliaceae family that you can put out in your garden that benefits a lot of different wildlife and insects. And so I'm just going to go to a couple other genera within this family of plants in the honeysuckle family. The one that I'm most excited about right now, and I did buy some seeds from Prairie Moon Nursery to try to grow these, and I've sort of done a little research to find out how I can go out and get my eyes on this plant in the wild and get some photos of it. But the name of the plant is Triosteum, which is T-R-I-O-S-T-E-U-M, and it is the common name of that is horse gentian. So take, if you can, just take a look at this plant, and the interesting thing about this plant is that it's got, it's not in the gentian family, obviously it's in the honeysuckle family. Aranticum is the orange-fruited horse gentian. Aranticum is the orange-fruited horse gentian. But so Google this and then look it up and take a look at the flowers. The flowers are a burgundy magenta red with very pretty little like yellow splotches in the axils of the stem and the leaf. The leaves are kind of, they almost look like they could be milkweed leaves, or I could see how this plant would get misidentified in vegetation if you weren't paying very close attention. It kind of looks like it could be some sort of tree species in the understory. It looks like it's growing around Thalictrum and blue cohosh, some of the Solomon seals and maiden's hair fern. So if you've got a rich piece of property, and by rich I mean calcium rich or limestone rich, on the western side of Vermont or Windsor County, so Bennington, Addison, Rutland, and Chittenden County, those are all possible areas in Vermont for this species to occur. And the flowers all occur in the axils, but when it goes to fruit, the fruit are this like bright orange color. They sort of look like kumquats or something. And it's just, I'm blown away at, how cool this thing is. It's uncommon in Vermont, rare in Rhode Island. It says it's fairly widespread in Massachusetts. It's extremely rare in New Hampshire and Maine. So that's one species of that genus here. The other one is Angustifolium, which is the lesser horse gentian. That's a Connecticut plant. This one's less pretty to me. It doesn't get that really deep orange color that the fruits on the Aranticum get. And then there's also a perfoliate-leaved horse gentian, which is Triosteum perfoliatum, which has similar red magenta-shaped flowers. And it looks like the leaves on this are a little more like that perfoliate, like that we were talking about before with the honeysuckles, where that stem comes right through the leaf. But this one also has the bright orange fruits, looks like in like a third more number of fruits around the stem and the leaf axles. And this one is southern Connecticut, southern Rhode Island, and like South Shore, Massachusetts into the Cape. And in all of those, so it's not in Vermont at all, but it's extremely rare in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. So it says it's unrankable in Connecticut, which probably means that it's fairly common, I would guess. And then its range entirely goes down the eastern seaboard into Georgia and Mississippi. The Aranticum also does that. So these are all plants that you could be, anyone on the East Coast, these are all things to keep your eyes open for. But just go and look at that. That plant will blow your mind. And the fact that it's a native New England plant is super cool. The other one, we'll just touch on this real quick. So Valeriana is a Aglaonosa, is a marsh valerian that's an S1 rare in one county in Vermont. Now, the valerian that all of you might be used to is officinalis, which is the common valerian, which is I see it, it's pretty ubiquitous around here, especially as you get up a little bit further north. And this one is a non-native, brought here because of its medicinal value, but it's has since escaped into a lot of different wetland situations, and it's kind of unfortunate because it's not very easy to see or treat, and it can be in great quantity, has a lot of seeds. It's just very, it just makes a site a little more complicated. So this would be something that you'd have to look into in terms of like hand pulling or figuring out how to sort of control it. I've taken, you know, had a few people ask me about how to do this, but it's not something that has really caught on in terms of an invasive plant here. Although I think that, you know, fairly soon it will be considered a pretty nasty invasive. So the other one is Aglaonosa, which is a marsh valerian, which, you know, we don't have marsh here technically in Vermont, but this one's occurring, looks like it's New York, Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, and then up into Canada. So it's actually doesn't occur down in the southern states at all. So this one's more of a northern species, in fens and swamps. And yeah, just one population in Vermont, one population in New Hampshire, and then up in northern Maine, up into like Arista County, there's some populations up there, but this one's normally associated with Fuchsia occidentalis swamps, so northern white cedar swamps and wooded fens. It says canopy closure from natural succession and changes to hydrology are probably the greatest threats to this species. So that one's pretty rare in New England. And the last one in the Caprifoliaceae episode is Linnaea borealis, which is the only species from this genus in New England. It's pretty ubiquitous everywhere, all over Maine, all over Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, a little bit into Connecticut, but then throughout the United States, it's going down to New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and then as far out as Wisconsin, Montana, Washington, up into northern Canada, Idaho, all the way down to New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona. So it's it has a really wide distribution. And in the New England area anyway, it's rare in Connecticut, uncommon in Massachusetts. Vermont doesn't have it listed at all, so it is a fairly common thing about here. But if you want to look at this is another really cool one. Really pretty flowers. You can just Google Linnaea borealis, B-O-R-E-A-L-I-S. And this is called American Twin Flower. So native plant to our region. Very showy flowers, magenta, pink, white. And, you know, from its name, it's got one stem divided into two that forks. And then at the top of those two forks, flowers bending over, one on each stem of that fork, and nodding downwards. So it can be like a little bit ground covery, and then you have these nice showy flowers that come up later. And there's some facts here on it. It says research has shown that American twin flower cannot pollinate close relatives and needs closely related individuals nearby in order to successfully set seed. Thus, if a population becomes smaller, isolated from others, it's more likely to die out. So there's probably some sort of mechanism that's evolved in here to really be structured around, you know, cross-pollination and outcrossing of these genes in order to help it survive. And that little fact comes from Go Botany. If you're not already a Go Botany fan, you should be. Native Plant Trust out of Framingham, Mass. Garden in the Woods. They have a website, gobotany.nativeplanttrust.org. You can look up, it sort of has a dichotomous key for all sorts of identification of native plants and invasive plants and non-native plants in New England, and it's really nice. Gives you a range map, tells you what family it's in. You can look up all kinds of different species, bunch of good photos. They're really, probably one of the best native plant garden conservancies, research places in the United States. So if you haven't already checked them out, go do that. As a roundup to this episode, next week I think we're going to be having Barry Glick in, which I don't know if any of you are familiar with Barry Glick. He's a fairly famous horticulturalist, botanist. He's out of West Virginia. Looking forward to talking to him. And hopefully we'll get Guardian of Terps. We'll figure out how to get in contact with Southern Russia and get him on the phone here. And we'll be talking to him about rhodiola and wild-type autoflowering cannabis plants, ruderalis. Otherwise, if you are interested, you want to send me an email about anything, it's plantsarepeopletopodcast@gmail.com. I have put up a link for a Patreon. If you feel moved to throw a couple bucks this way to help support the podcast, it's much appreciated. I'm doing this in my free time right now as part of my winter doldrums, trying to keep everything at bay in terms of, because there's no plants out right now. But if you're interested, that would be much appreciated, throwing some money at that. And then what else was I going to say? If you have any suggestions on anybody that you want to hear on the podcast, or you think I should talk to, or you have plant questions, feel free to shoot me an email. I'm always interested in talking to different people, especially people I don't know necessarily. I'll reach out to them and get them on here and hopefully get you some good information on what you want to hear. Other than that, I hope you guys are enjoying it, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.